kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah, let it play. Share it, yeah, pass it on your way. Sub up, don't hesitate. David L. Gray in the morning, don't be late. Welcome in to David L. Gray in the morning. Glad to have you here for this Wednesday of the Octave of Easter. This is wild. So Bishop Barron somehow managed to just make everyone angry. When I say everyone, I mean everyone. And I don't understand why at all. So we have to talk about that on today's David L. Gray in the morning. Also, we'll talk about the readings for today, for Wednesday of the Octave of Easter. And we're going to talk about how St. Benedict of Nursa, St. Benedict the Great, decided to claim me when I was in Rome. And also, this is a crazy story as well. So there's this lady named Kiki Latimer from some podcast called The Catholic Bookworm. They're trying to give your boy a bad day yesterday. I've got to talk about that because I think the story is hilarious. Then we're going to wrap up everything today with my thoughts on Pope Leo the 14th, moving closer to declaring that most wars are just inadmissible. Not that there's no such thing as a just war, but there's this trajectory in place, this sort of development of the church's doctrine on just war, that I think he's getting closer and closer to moving to this place where the church is ready to say that most wars are just inadmissible. So we're going to talk about that. That's going to be spicy when that comes out. So there's no saint of the day on the universal calendar. So like I said, we're going to talk about Saint Benedict of Nursia, or Saint Benedict the Great, as he's typically called. And, so I was, and let me first say that our saint of the day is being sponsored by Saint Dominic's Media, that's saintdominicsmedia.com. If you're interested in living the liturgical life, learning how to be in the world who God has formed you to be through the liturgy, hop over to St. Dominic's Media. Everything that we do there is built around that question, like how do I live the liturgical life, from retreats, online retreats, to courses, to books, to podcasts, to essays. Everything is free except for the books, of course. So hop on there. Bookmark it. Make sure you join our mailing list. Also, while you're over there, make sure that you click the link in the drop down that talks about the contemplative Dominican rosary. I don't know if you ever prayed the contemplative Dominican rosary, but so it's easier to get into. There's not a lot of preface to get into the actual prayers of the rosary, so that's one thing that's different. Also, it's contemplative, which means that you really spend a lot more time contemplating the mysteries. Right. And so as Dominicans, we believe that if you study well, then you can contemplate well. And if you contemplate well, then you can pray well. So if you study well, you can therefore contemplate that what you studied, and you can better pray that what you contemplated. And therefore, you can out of that, you can be in the world who God has formed you to be through the liturgy. So you can live a life that's more in continuity with all the holy things and the good things. So check that out. It's called the Contemplative Dominican Rosary. It's in audio, it's in video, and also you just read it. So check that out. That's saying Saint Dominic's Media, our sponsor for today's Saint of the Day. So what happened was, so I'm that type of person. I believe that a rosary prayer bead is kind of like a wife to a man. Meaning that you don't find your rosary finds you, right? She just kind of pops up like Eve. She usually comes around a time in your life where you think, you know, where you needed some help or helpmate, right? So a rosary is like a wife. And so, yeah, I don't believe that you find your rosary. I believe that your rosary finds you. And so I think in your life, you're going to have many different types of rosaries. maybe seasonal. You may have one that you just have all your life. That's, you know, that's how it is. But I always tell people, if you want to get into the habit of praying the rosary daily, you have to come across a rosary that you can't put down, a rosary that you see it and you just want to pray. It just for whatever reasons, the colors, it feels good in your hand, has a story behind it or something like that. You have to find a rosary that just says deep with you. And so we went to Rome. I left my rosary in, you know, the security thing where you're going through security, get to the airplane. I left it in there, left it on those buckets, that thing. So I'm in Rome with no rosary. So I find one, you know, one of those little corner places, and it's like a glow-in-the-dark rosary, which I thought was childish but cool at the same time, like glow-in-the-dark rosary. And so I was using that for a couple of days. And then we hop over to, I think one of you guys in the comments told me, oh, Dave, you have to go over to St. Mary Major. And you have to get the image that they have there. And the image is called the Salvation of the Roman People. And it is, it's this image. It's a, like a Byzantine type of image. It's like 1500 years old. So it's Byzantine style. And so it had always been in Rome, where the Roman people anciently adored this image because, it's really just the oldest, most important icon of Mary in Rome. Like I said, because Romans always believed that the image protected the city. They believed that it intercedes in plagues, wars, disasters, and it's really a sign of Mary's maternal care. And so popes from Gregory to Francis have invoked this rosary. And so it's carried in papal processions, icons of popes visit before and after apostolic journey. Is considered a protective icon for the entire city of Rome. And so it's only housed in the Pauline Chapel of St. Mary Major. So that's why I'm there. Right, so that's why I'm there. You know, you guys say, oh, you got, while you're there, you got to go get this icon. So I did. It's beautiful. But so while we're there, you know, I'm looking around, poking around. I have some great gifts, and like gifts are like really priced really well, better than like St. Paul Outside the Walls, which is like a beautiful gift store with like a food court and everything. But just prices are crazy. They have wine, they have spirits, but crazy, crazy prices. But here I'm like, man, these prices are like remarkable. So then I happen upon, I see this rosary here. And I can't take my eyes off of it, not because I like red. In fact, I don't like red. Going back to my college days, you know, a rival fraternity wore red, so I really don't care for red. But I couldn't take my eyes off of it. So again, I think your rosary finds you. You don't find your rosary. So I bought it, and so now this is the one I've been praying. And, you know, when I got home, I still wanted to use it. Typically, I use this really long one back there. You can see the long rosary hanging. That's typically what I use. But then I couldn't put this one down. So today, this morning, I'm praying the rosary. And I never took a look at like the icons, like who's on here, like these images. And I found out it was Saint Benedict the Great. And Saint Benedict Nursia, which is, you know, he's from central Italy, you know, east of Rome. And so I said, oh, wow. You know, I never really thought much about him, knew about him. You know, the rule of St. Benedict, the sister, St. Scholastica, you know, their religious orders, you know, not that whole thing. But then I looked up the Latin letters on the back of the icon, and I found out it's actually an exorcism prayer, which is like, okay, that's what we've been talking about on this channel for like weeks, right? In spiritual warfare. And I found out that St. Benedict, he's not just known for his starting religious order and the rule of Benedict, but he's actually known for spiritual warfare. So anyway, the prayer of exorcism on the back of this, it says that, may the holy cross be my light. Let not the dragon be by my side. Be gone, Satan. Never tip me with your vanities. What you offer me is evil. Drink your own poison. I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I found out his spiritual warfare is really just about just discipline and obedience. You know, like guarding your thoughts, disciplining your imagination, resisting murmuring, rejecting self-will, and things like that. So it's basically, you know, prefer nothing to Christ. So yeah, I thought that was a really cool story I wanted to share with you guys, since we didn't have a saint today, and how I happened across my new rosary that I love. All right, let's get into today's commentaries at a Reason Mass. This has been David L. Gray in the morning. Hey, before we get into today's commentary for Reason Mass, I want to remind you about my book, The Liturgical Sense for the Reason Mass. This is your A, but we have them for years B and for years C. If you want to learn how to live the liturgical life, that is how to live the Mass in the world in your daily life, this is your book. Also, it unpacks scriptures in very insightful and very Catholic ways. But what I really want you to do is to make sure you go over to stdominicsmedia.com and sign up for our mailing list. Because what if you don't like to read? What if you don't like words on paper? What if you don't have time? Well, I have something for you as well. If you join a mailing list, you'll get the audio version of this book for every reading at Mass for that particular Sunday in your email box for free. So sign up for our mailing list. Again, that's at stdominicsmedia.com. Let's go ahead and get into the commentary for today's readings of Mass. Thank you. Welcome back, Kansas. David L. Gray in the morning. Today is the Wednesday of the octave of Easter. So since it is the fourth day in the octave of Easter, we are talking about Emmaus. And so the first reading for Mass is from Acts, where Peter and John, they're going up to the temple. And then the responsorial psalm is, "Rejoice, all hearts that seek the Lord," from Psalm 105. And then a gospel reading is from Luke, chapter 24, verses 13 through 35. And so this is when it says that the very first day, the first day of the week, two of the disciples were going to a village 7 miles from Jerusalem called Emmaus. And they were conversing about all things that had occurred. And then it happened while they were conversing and debating, Jesus himself drew near and walked with them. But their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. Then he asked them, "What are you discussing as you walk along?" They stopped, looking downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, said to him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know these things that have taken place here these days?" And then he replies to them, "What sort of things?" They said to him, "The things that happened to Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. How our chief priests and rulers both handed him over to be sentenced to death and crucified him. But they were hoping that he would be the one to redeem Israel. And besides all this, it is now the third day since it took place. Some women from our group, however, has astounded us. They were at a tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. They came back and reported that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who announced that he was alive. Then some of those with us went to the tomb and found these things as the women had described, but they did not see him. And they said to him, 'How foolish are you? How slow of heart to believe that all the prophets spoke? Was it not necessary that Jesus should go suffer these things and enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them what referred to him in all the scriptures." Then here is the crucible point where the story turns. It says, as they approached the village to which they were going, he gave them impression that he was going on farther. But they urged him, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening and the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. And that right there is really the crucible, the turning point in this whole story. I want to spend just a little bit of time here to contemplate on and lead you into this encounter. So this point right here, the story, is about conversion and it's about awakening. So the Emmaus narrative reaches its really decisive turning point in this small explosive moment when it says, as they approached the village to which they were going, he gave the impression that he was going on farther, but they urged him to stay with us. So he went in to stay with them. So up until this point, Jesus had been the one directing the entire conversation, entire encounter. He's drawing near. He's questioning them. He's interpreting the scriptures. He's enlightening their hearts and enlightening their hearts. But this is the moment where the initiative shifts. The disciples receive the revelation. It's kind of like as a Eucharist, it's a liturgical type of scene here, right? They receive the liturgy of the word, but they have not yet received communion, right? They have heard the word, but have not yet encountered the word. So again, this is the crucible moment, the moment where revelation meets freedom. So this is where we're created for. The reason why we have freedom is so that we can find God. So Jesus had just opened the scriptures to them, or the first great post-resurrection catechesis that we see here, that their hearts are burning. They're standing on the threshold of conversion. And then Jesus does something astonishing. He acts as if he will go on. So this is not disinterest. This is divine pedagogy. It's the same God who knocks on a door but does not break it open. The same God who calls out to Samuel, but waits for Samuel to speak, say, "Speak, Lord," right? The same God who stands at the door and waits to be invited in. So revelation has been given, but relationship requires consent. So they have to choose. Yeah. And the disciples' invitation, when they say, "Stay with us," is really the first moment of discipleship. It's the beginning of the story. This is where the moment where they move from, I would say, receiving information to seeking communion. The moment when listening to the word moves to welcoming the word, right? It moves from being taught to being transformed, right? So this is the hinge of the entire narrative. Without this invitation, there is no table, there's no breaking bread, there's no recognition, there's no mission. So then the text says, so he went in to stay with them, right? And so God responds instantly to, I think, the smallest moment, the smallest movements of the human heart. He doesn't need much to come into our situation, right? He just needs a little bit of brokenness, a little bit of humility, openness to him, right? And then he doesn't hesitate. He doesn't negotiate. He turns towards us, right, in that moment. So this is the gospel, an entire gospel right here in Emmaus. If you never read anything else in the gospels, you've read it all right here. That God is always ready to go farther with us, but he's always waiting for an invitation, right? And it sounds like a paradox. Like, how can both these things be true? He wants to go farther with us, but he waits for the invitation, right? And I think many people experience what the disciples experienced on the road to Emmaus, right? They hear the scriptures. They feel something stir within their hearts. Their hearts burn, but they stop. They stop there. Right, so, but what Emmaus is teaching us, that the word of God is not is that hearing the word of God is not the same as encountering the word of God. Right? Revelation prepares a heart, but encounter happens when the word stays with us. So only then does Jesus take the bread, break it, bless it. And in the breaking of the bread, they see him. Right? So in our life, I think we just have to remember that Jesus will walk with anyone who will listen. He'll walk with anyone who will listen, like he walked with the disciples. But he will stay with only those who invite him. So these are the two types of people. There are those who hear the word on the way to somewhere, and there are those who invite the word to stay with them. So think about those things on this octave of Easter. And because it's worthy of consideration. All right, let's go ahead and get into our first story. This is David L. Gray in the morning. I'll be right back.
Hey there, I am David L. Gray. I am a Catholic theologian getting my doctoral degree in liturgical catechesis from the Catholic University of America. And this is my morning show. Welcome in. We do this every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Start off with Joy in the Morning, where I give you the saint of the day and an enlightening commentary on the readings of Mass. And then we get into something interesting. I'm looking at something in faith or culture from a lens of a Catholic who believes in faith, reason, logic, and the teachings of the church. There's no deviation from the magisterium here. Why people like this channel, why people sub, why people keep coming back is because I look at things from a very critical lens. This is no emotions applied, no groupthink, no talking points to the day, none of that. Nothing can't be. I'm not saying what I'm supposed to say. I'm saying what's true. Sometimes we get in those boxes, and I think that's very dangerous when we get comfortable and we just go along with what people think and what we're supposed to believe. No, you know, if it's not dogmatic truth, then we ask the questions, why? And so that's what we're doing here. And I hope that you like it. Yeah, I may get emotional myself. I may call something stupid or retarded. I may crack some jokes. But that's, again, that's why people like this channel. That's why they sub. That's why they share. That's why they like. That's why they join a community. And I hope that you do too. Let's get back to the show. All right, so this is wild. So let me tell you a little story about patience, because I've been working on my anger. I've gotten a lot better. I think a lot better over the last 30 or so years. Just trying to be a better human, better Catholic, a calmer man. A man who doesn't immediately like flip over tables when someone, tests my patience. And that's fair, right? Because think about how many times Jesus throughout his whole life had walked past the money changers in the temple. How many times that happened? At least once a year when they would go up for the Passover. But finally, he gets to the point where enough is enough and he flips over the tables. And so, or how many times did, Peter kind of like work his nerves before he said, "Get behind me, Satan"? Was it instant, or was like a buildup to Peter not trusting other things? We don't know, right? But that's why I'm trying to be patient, right? I'm trying to get to the point where I don't turn over the tables, for about 30 years. not really me, but I'm trying. And then this whole Kiki Latimer thing happened. Now, if you never heard of Kiki Latimer or her Catholic Bookworm podcast on WCAT radio, don't worry, neither has the rest of the planet. Her show gets about 5 or something views, and one of them is probably her cat walking across the keyboard. And I thought I was doing her a favor, right, by hopping onto her podcast, maybe getting her into some triple digits, because sometimes David O. Gray attracts more views, right? But the Lord, you ever woke up and the Lord said, I'm about to test you. So I said, I'm about to test you today. You don't know what the test is. You just got a feeling that's coming. All right, so here it comes, right? So we're at strike one. Last week when I'm in Rome, it's Friday. I'm on vacation in Rome, Holy Week, Good Friday. And I get a last minute email from Kiki's people saying that Kiki never received my book that I'm coming on her show to review. Mind you, I mailed the book back in December. She got it on January 21st. That's what the post office says, right? I'm a little annoyed, but okay. I breathe. I'm working on my anger. I get a chance, Friday, Monday, when I get back home, I get a chance to send a PDF. All right, cool. Then strike two comes. All right, so 40 minutes before I'm supposed to go into her show, she emails me again. Not to say hello, not to say that she's excited about the show, excited about reviewing my book. No,
to send me some guidelines and these list of concerns about a paragraph or two. Page like 73. So she didn't get too far into the book. You know, she's skimming it while, I don't know, microwaving some soup. But by the way, the copy of the paragraph she had issues with was from the paperback. Right. So apparently St. Anthony helped her find a book. Good. So this is 40 minutes before the show. About a paragraph that she didn't understand. Mind you, I had rearranged my afternoon, this afternoon here, to go in this podcast, talk about my book at 4 o'clock, rearranged my afternoon to make time for this. I'm okay. I breathe again. I'm working on my anger. You know, I respond politely. You know, I explain the paragraphs. I clarify the theology. I use small words. And I encourage her that the whole thing is in continuity with each other. You can't isolate sentences out of the whole text. Then strike three comes. She writes back, cancels the interview. Because she still can't understand. Can't understand how these chapters make sense, right? And at that point, it's time to turn over tables. Like, I'm done. I just can't anymore with this Kiki. All right, my patience hit a meter zero, right? My guardian angel clocked out. You know, basically told me good luck. Apparently, I don't have the guardian angel that Father Ripperger said the Blessed Mother Mary has. You know, that can take away her free will and sanctify her. No one's around to take away my free will. Maybe more sacrificial. I'm left to my own devices, so I flip tables. And here's the kicker. The paragraph that she couldn't understand, the one that she says is just too problematic for my guidelines, the one she says contradicted the church, it was literally on humility. Humility. Not the Trinity. Not the hypostatic union. Not how Jesus is impassible. Not the Council of Trent. Not the Philoke. Not the metaphysics of transubstantiation. None of that. Humility. And this somehow broke her. She read a passage about the remnant, the humble, the faithful, the lowly, and decided that I was attacking the magisterium, the priesthood of the church, the Eucharist, and probably her dog. Meanwhile, the entire point of the whole chapter, the whole reflection for that Sunday's readings, which was the fifth Sunday in ordinary time, in the first readings from Isaiah, is talking about these very things, humility. And that's what the whole thing is about. And then the chapter is about how the liturgy forms us to be a humble people. And so I'm making these distinctions between extreme pride, snatching the Holy Eucharist, which, you know, people come up and they just snatch it, versus extreme humility. Someone crawling on their knees for a mile to receive the Holy Eucharist, not in their hands, but on their tongues. Just humility. So I'm showing the distinctions, okay? And I'm showing the distinctions between a remnant people who are, you know, the faithful are always, throughout the history of the church, the faithful and even the Jewish religion, there always have been in tension with the religious leaders who are not very, oftentimes not very interested in sainthood or holiness. They have other interests. So there's always this tension between the two, right? This is what the chapter is about, right? So that was the problematic issue for Kiki Lattimore at the Catholic Bookworm podcast. She isolated three sentences, ignored context, ignored paragraphs before it, ignored paragraphs after it, ignored the theme, ignored the title, ignored the scripture references, ignored the point, and declared the whole thing too problematic minutes before I was supposed to go on her podcast. I just found that to be completely unprofessional, and I read her the riot act. But also at that moment, I realized that something had happened. I had failed the test. I was supposed to suffer her low reading comprehension ability and insults to my writing, but I didn't. I was close. But she just had to send that last email. This is David L. Gray in the morning. Let's get to our top story with Bishop Barron. You know, back in the day, and I'm talking about like real 1990s culture here. Remember when people used to like personalize their emails? Well, I'm sorry, their voicemails. I'm sorry, not their voicemails, their answer machine. Remember answer machines? You know, not voicemail. You know, I think that came later. That term came later because I think we had email. And so somebody, some genius said we have to have voicemail, right? A very linguistic transition there, you know, but I digress. You know, my friend's wife had an answer machine. They had an answer machine. And it was her voice on the answer machine. And I remember their message was something I'll never forget. Because I use the phrase often. What she said on the answer machine is that if you don't feel, you know, she said, this is Cedric and Renita. Thanks for calling. If you don't feel close as you used to, if you don't feel as close to God as you used to, who move? Leave a message. Beep. If you don't feel as close to God as you used to, who moved? That's true. Because God doesn't move. He's always the same. You know, the theological word is that he's impassible. He doesn't have mood swings. He doesn't have emotions like we have emotions. He's just always the same God. So if you don't feel as close to God as you used to, it wasn't God who moved. It was you. Similarly, if you feel closer to God than you used to, it wasn't God who moved. You just drew nearer to him. So I love that line because it's, you know, it's true. And it brings me to something strange that's happening in Catholic media right now. It's like every ideological tribe from every side has suddenly woken up and looked at Bishop Robert Barron, this is the same Barron we've known for decades, and said, you know what? It's your turn to get it. Everyone. And the funniest part is that they're all mad at him for completely different reasons. And so I'm about to break down the six different groups. And I gave them all names. And the first one is here, as you see on the screen. This is the conservative pop culture crowd. I'm led by Candace Owens. Now, Candace is really a special case. God bless her. She's became Catholic what, about 5 minutes ago. The charism oil is still wet. The baptismal candle is still warm. Her OCI name tag is still sitting on, you know, her kitchen table, probably next to the air fryer. Yet somehow, in record time, she has ascended to the highest office in the land, the supreme pontiff of the online magisterium. The speed of this rise is incredible. Like most Catholics spend years learning the basics of the faith. You know, the sacraments, the saints, a little Thomas Aquinas. No. She walked out of Easter Vigil and immediately started issuing apostolic exhortations on geopolitics. But here's the thing. Her issue with Bishop Barron isn't that he's anti-war. No. That would be too simple. No. Candace's concern is a whole cinematic universe of suspicion, right? According to her, Jordan Peterson once worked with people that she calls ultra-Zionists. And now Bishop Barron is teaching a course on Peterson's platform. And Barron once appeared next to Paula White. And years ago, he made a comment about salvation she didn't like. And therefore, she wants clarity regarding these allegiances. This is the energy of someone who has been Catholic for 33 minutes and already has a court board with the white string connecting the dots of Bishop Barron, Jordan Peterson, Paula White, and the Council of Trent, and a couple of Jews. Her complaint basically boils down to, I've been Catholic for less than one liturgical season, and I'm just deeply concerned about the bishops. She wants a bishop who will, I don't know, what, quote Thomas Aquinas, denounce every person she likes, dislikes, especially the Jewish kind, and do it all in a 90-second clip that's formatted for X. Barron didn't do that. So now she's mad. And the funniest part is that Candace is out here talking like she's the prefect for the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith, when in reality, she's just probably just trying to figure out where the holy water font is at her parish, and which we all know is the hardest thing to find. So that's that group, the conservative pop culture. Now, the other people who are mad at Barron, I call them the farty right Catholics, the farty right Catholics, led by Michael Lofton. So yeah, now we move on to the other extreme, the farty right Catholics, led probably by Michael Lofton, who has become, I think, really just the unofficial Catholic hall monitor for the orthodoxy on YouTube, right? Now these people are not far right, but, you know, right of center, you know, like you and I, like, you know, like us, people who are subscribed to this channel, right? But, you know, right of center. But because they're full of gas and hot air is why we call them the farty right. Right. So these are the folks who believe that if a Protestant so much as walked past a Catholic, a minor exorcism should be performed. They treat ecumenism the way some people treat gluten, you know, fear, a vague sense that it may cause hives. I don't know. And their big complaint about Bishop Barron, he prayed with Paula White. Yeah, Paula White, you know, the prosperity gospel preacher lady who prays like she's trying to reboot the spiritual Wi-Fi at Mar-a-Lago. So Barron shows up at a prayer gathering, not a mass, not a sacrament, not a doctrinal council, just a prayer gathering for the president of the United States. And suddenly Lofton is on YouTube acting like Barron personally consecrated the Trump Hotel chapel with holy water from Joel Osteen's swimming pool. Like, Lofton's complaint in one sentence is that why won't Bishop Barron rebuke Trump publicly? Why won't he rebuke him publicly and forcefully and preferably with a dogma bowl upside his head? Like, he wants Barron to march up to Trump like a medieval inquisitor, slam a Denzinger's on the table and shout, "Recant! Recant, sir!" And when Barron doesn't do that, because Barron is, well, you know, a bishop, not a WWE wrestler or referee, Lofton loses his mind. He's upset that Barron prayed with crazy Protestants, didn't rebuke a crazy president, didn't rebuke crazy people who didn't rebuke President Trump, didn't rebuke crazy people who didn't rebuke crazy people who didn't rebuke President Trump, right? It's just rebukes all the way down. And the funniest part is that Lofton wants Barron to be like some sort of just theologically xenophobic, not towards other religions, but towards anything that's not stamped with his personal brand of Catholicism, right? He wants Barron to treat Protestants like they're radioactive. He wants Barron to treat Trump like he's a catechism quiz gone wrong. He wants Barron to treat public prayer like as a trap set by the Freemasons. But Barron is the same guy he's always been, you know, the Vatican II Catholic. Let's evangelize culture, everybody. Let's dialogue with everyone. Find seeds of the word, right? Beauty leads to truth. You know, that's what Barron is about. Let's not hit world leaders with dogma bowls, right? He's not. I guess he's not isolationist enough. He's not angry enough. The Baron is for these people. He's not allergic to Protestants. He's not performing the public exorcisms that Lofton wants. So now that group is mad. The 40 right Catholics. Now let's get to the next group that is mad. There's six of them. We're on three so far. So this group, I stole this phrase from Christine Harrington from Eternal Life Plan. She has this term called Catholipoly. You know, Catholics who are just all into the politics. They don't have a king named Jesus. No, they you know, who's ever in charge of the government is who they're obsessed with, right? The Catholipoly is the, what she's called, what she calls. I think it's a great term, and it rhymes. So now we get to the political commentators, the people who treat every bishop statement like it's a State of the Union address and every omission like it's Watergate. So this group is amazing because they're all mad at Barron, but for completely different reasons, because they're both left and right. All right. Now, on the anti-war Catholic side, you have folks like Robert Schneck, John Gearing, people like on Twitter, I think it's called the Pax Christi Twitter chapter. And so they all insist that Barron did not condemn the civil deaths of that happened in Iran with enough fire and brimstone. They wanted him to sound like a Jesuit peace study professor, you know, to kind of have like tenure, you know, weird and crazy. Right? Then on the pro-military Catholic side, right, the, you know, people like Raymond Arroyo, EWTN for old Gerald Murray, you know, the guys that want to see everyone die. You know, they think the death penalty is a sacrament. War is a sacrament. You know, and EWTN has something called a Pentagon desk. So these warmongers are all insisting that Barron didn't defend U.S. action strong enough. Right? These Catholipolies, they wanted him to selectively quote Aquinas and Augustine and a joint chiefs of staff in one sentence. And so, yeah, both sides, they're furious at the same moment about the same thing, that the Ben Shapiro interview, right? I'll play that in a minute. They swear that Barron dodged the question. They swear he played it safe. They swear that he didn't take a stand. Meanwhile, Barron is sitting there like answering like just, I think maybe a normal bishop. And the political commentators, acting like he just refused to testify before Congress. Lock him up. You know, their complaint in one sentence that we disagree with each other on everything, but we all agree that Barron is the problem. So those are your Catholipolies. All right. So they're big mad as well. All right. So now you have here's the other group. I call them the secular critics. All right, these are the secular critics. So this group is the easiest to understand because they don't understand anything. Not at all. They don't understand anything. They don't know what a bishop does. They don't know what evangelization is. They think the magisterium is a Harry Potter spell. You know, they're mad because, you know, Barron showed up at a White House prayer event, which they interpret as political, which means that he must be endorsing something which must be stopped. So on this side, you have people like Mehdi Hasan, Joy Reid, and, you know, the religion reporters, you know, from everywhere who don't go to church, like the ones at NPR. All insisting that Barron legitimize Christian nationalism simply by standing next to Paula White and Franklin Graham. You know, their worldview, I think, is really simple, that if a person appears anywhere near politics, if a religious person appears anywhere near politics is a threat to our democracy. Right? They don't care about theology. They don't care about prayer. They don't care about context. What they care about is the optics. Right? And Barron's optics offended their sensibilities. So now they're mad, right? Here is the fifth group, right? And I'll use the Rorschach symbol here because it explains everything if you enter Rorschach. So calling the YouTube crowd, so they're like the algorithmic mob, right? The digital visual villagers, with pitchforks made of ring lights and USB webcams. So this group includes, your Catholic reactionary channels, the ex-Catholic reactionary channels, the I watch a clip of something and now I have a take channels, right? And I don't go to mass at all, but I have opinions about bishop channels, right? So they're mad because, Barron is too safe. He's too political. He's not political enough. He's too friendly with Jordan Peterson. He's not friendly enough with Jordan Peterson. He's compromised. He's an elitist. He's lukewarm. He's way too bold. He's not bold enough. So they want Barron to be everything and nothing at the same time. He's becoming the Rorschach test of like the Catholic media. It's a mirror. The Rorschach test is a mirror that reveals more about the creator and the viewer than the thing itself. Just like the psychological ink blot test. It tells you who you are. And here is the last group. And this is my favorite group. Right here of all. It's the Karen's Caring for Carry Coalition, the KFC, right? And, they're here because, the saga just needed one more subplot. So here comes the Karen's Caring for Carry Coalition, led by none other than Carrie Pigeon Bowler herself. Now, this group is convinced that Bishop Barron committed an unforgivable act of omission. He didn't publicly defend Carrie when she was removed from the Religious Freedom Committee, right? Their worldview is simple, that if Carrie sneezes, the bishop should issue some sort of statement. If Carrie stubs her toe, the USCCB should call a press conference. If Carrie is removed from a committee, Bishop Barron should ride on horseback like he's Aragorn headed to Gondor, right? But Bishop Barron, he didn't do that. He didn't tweet. He didn't have like a photo op. He didn't release a video. He didn't issue a pastoral letter on the dignity of Carrie Pigeon and the injustice of her removal. No, he didn't write that. And so the Karen's Caring for Carrie Coalition, KFC, rose up and just righteous indignation led by her. And their complaint in one sentence is, why didn't Bishop Barron defend Carrie like she's the last remnant of Western civilization? Without her, what do we do? They wanted him to storm Capitol Hill like it was January 6th with a copy of the catechism in one hand and a megaphone shouting in the other. To restore Carrie to the committee. But Barron, he's just the same calm, steady beauty, goodness, truth stuff guy he's always been. He's not a political crusader. He's not a culture war general. He's not a patron saint of the advisory committee disputes. So now they're mad. So everyone sees what they want to see, and they all get mad about it. But here's the thing that confuses me is that Barron hasn't changed. Not in all the decades I've known him. He's always been exactly who he is now. Call it what you want to. He's always been that person. Right, and here's the part, really, that I mean, it makes the circus even funnier. I mean, even that, I get, he hasn't changed, not one inch, not one pixel, not one syllable. He is still the beauty, goodness, and truth guy. He still leads with the transcendentals, right? He's still fine to seize in a culture guy. He's still the Jesus can be encountered in anything good or beautiful or true. That's the guy he is. He's been saying this since the Catholicism series. You guys remember that? I had that old DVD, the World on Fire DVDs. I had those. The early YouTube days, right? Remember? He's talking about you can start evangelization with Bob Dylan. Or Dante. That's who he is. Let's evangelize through beauty. Right? I used to, you know, I back in the day when I had a blog, I used to write against all that stuff. I thought that was the craziest idea. Start with beauty? Why don't we start with truth? And mind you, when I became a Catholic, I read Barron, I watched Barron. I didn't know the difference back then. Like, because remember, I became a Catholic because I read the catechism. And I thought all Catholics believe what was in the catechism. So I'm reading people on just what I found out was like the far, far left. And I was reading people on the far right. Like, and I was watching Carapi, right? And I'm reading Thomas Merton, you know, people like that. So I'm like everywhere. I didn't know. And Barron, so I'm watching Barron too, right? I kind of outgrow Barron pretty fast because I figure out his homily. Like I say, you know, bishop, priests just have one homily. Once you figure out their one homily, they're, you know, it's just gonna rinse and repeat the same points. And Barron's, his one homily is, you know, the things that I mentioned, right? And, you know, he's been that same guy. He's, you know, the reasonable hope that all might be saved. Remember that, right? He's the same guy who said, if you see something beautiful, you're seeing a trace of God, right? And when he said that, the entire internet nodded politely. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Everyone nodded politely. Yeah, that makes sense. Right. Now he says the same thing in her internet screams. Heresy, globalism, modernism, softness. Why aren't you yelling at Trump? Why aren't you yelling at Iran? Why aren't you yelling at everyone? Meanwhile, Baird is just sitting there sipping tea, quoting Aquinas, and talking about stained glass windows over at the Chartres Cathedral. He hasn't changed. Rather, the internet has turned into some sort of caffeinated toddler with a theology degree from TikTok. I really wish we can go back to the good old days. Don't you wish that? Don't you wish we could go back to the good old days? Like, you remember the good old days, right? When the only people mad at Robert Barron, whether he is father, whether he's bishop, were the rad trads. You remember that? They were the only people who were mad at him. Those are just simpler times, weren't they? I remember those, the good old days. Like, back then, the scandal was Bishop Barron said that he has a reasonable hope that Father James Martin could be saved. Mm-hmm. That literally broke the internet. What he said, he has a reasonable hope that everyone who we have a problem with, who we think are going to hell, could be saved. And the rad trash just clutched their rosaries. What? What? Oh, wait, they didn't just clutch their rosaries, right? They pulled out their stogies, right? Let me imitate a rad trad for you. Because they're always smoking, always drinking, right? I got a cigar. He said all people can be saved. That's impossible. That's impossible. Salvation is for those who agree with me on liturgy.
as they clutched their rosaries and smoked their cigar. That was it. That was the whole controversy. And Barron would say something like, God is love. And the Rad Trads would respond, modernism. That was funny. It's funny. Like Barron would say, God is love. And a Rad Trads would say, modernism. Modernism. Right, but those were the days. Those were the peaceful, nostalgic days when only one group hated him, but they hated him consistently. Now, he's being attacked from the left, from the right, from the far right, the secular left, the YouTube algorithm, the Catholic, the Catholipolis, the Protestant commentariat, the ex-Catholic commentariat, Candace Owens, who became Catholic like 33 seconds ago and already is issuing like papal bulls on X, and of course the KFC, the Karens Caring for Carrie Coalition, right? It is chaos. It is just theological anarchy. It's basically a digital food fight. I mean, let's be honest with you. It's a digital, you know, Bishop Barron didn't move. The internet moved. And it moved into a padded room. These are crazies out here. They're crazies. They're crazy. I would never suggest that anyone goes on X and hear anything the Catholics have to say out there. Everyone has lost their mind. It makes me scared to come back to the United States. Like, is this normal back in the States now? Like, what's going on? You know, Felicia and I, we think about coming back to the States, you know, because we have a window. We have windows when we could come back, right? A window is coming up in 2027, which is like next year. There's a window when we could come back, but these people are crazy. Like, do we want to really, is this normal? Like, we don't know. Like, we don't know. Like, we don't want these type of people as our neighbors. So it's like, and even YouTube is just insanity. I mean, I think we have an oasis here. I think we're kind of normal here. But you leave the David L. Gray channel and a few other channels, you know, yeah. It doesn't take long to get into some stuff where people are just... Everyone's just kind of like really extreme right now. Really extreme. So I don't know. But yeah, but you know, I contend that Yankee City girl, she says it's normal in the real world. Okay. That's good to hear. You know, I might take your word on that, but I tell you what, if I move back next year. And I'm living next to someone from the Care for Carrie Coalition. You know, I'm going to look you up, Yankee girl. I'm going to have a long conversation. I can't have these people as my neighbors. I just can't. Right? But yeah. I digress. You know, Barron didn't change. The internet did. And the internet is now a place where everyone wants a bishop to agree with them, and they get angry when it doesn't. I don't know. And like I said, and I say this as a person who I'm not the biggest Barron fan. I haven't read him or listened to him in like over a decade and a half, at least. Last time I really sat down and listened to Barron or read something was like 2010 or something like that. So I've been off Barron for a long time. And remember, you guys remember when I had my radio show on Guadalupe Radio Network,
I was trying to get somebody in from Word on Fire to, his name was Dominic, something like that. I think I knew him personally. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe so. Anyway, I kind of know the guy, but he's working for Word on Fire now. And I wanted him on my radio show to have like a conversation. So he has to go ask the people at Word on Fire, can he come on the David L. Gray show? And they tell him no, which pissed me off. Because like I said, I'm just a guy in the middle. Sometimes I do say some extreme things, but largely I'm in the middle, right? But even when I say extreme things, they're like normal. They sound extreme. But I think they're normal. But anyway, yeah, so but the Word on Fire say you can't come on my show. I've been agnostic towards Baron. Haven't really paid attention to him, but I've just thumbs down to Word on Fire for like about 5 years now because they wouldn't let somebody come on my show. So I say all this to say that Baron's normal. He hasn't changed as a person who has no stake in the game. I'm not here to defend Baron. I'm just saying he hasn't changed. So why is everyone mad? Again, it's because the internet changed. This has been David L. Gray in the morning. Let's get to this last story because it ties in to the whole thing. Yankee Girl City says, if you move next door to one of them, we're a GoPro at all times. Oh, yeah. You don't have to worry about that. Last time I lived in the States, we were outside of St. Louis. And I just had cameras all around the house. Like, all around the house. Like, even on the mailbox, I had cameras. Like, I don't play. I even have cameras inside the house. You know, it's like, you don't worry. That's not even a concern right there. I always have my six, my 12 and my 3 covered at all times. All right, let's get into this because this whole thing does tie in. I'm going to play a couple of videos for you. One is with Shapiro, and then the other one is with Pope Leo the 14th. And then I'm going to talk really quick about where I see this whole thing moving with Just War. And I think it's going to go the same place, sort of, as we saw the death penalty go. I see a development of doctrine here that's been on a move since Vatican II. Right. So I want to talk to you about that. And first, let me play these clips.
And to discuss this, the rest of current events, and of course, it's Holy Week, is Bishop Robert Barron. He, of course, is the bishop of the Diocese of Winona, Rochester, and is one of the most prominent Catholic voices in modern media. And he, of course, is the head of Word on Fire Catholic Ministries. Bishop Barron, thanks so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Ben, good to see you as always.
So let's do some news of the day, and then we'll talk about Holy Week more broadly. So obviously made a lot of headlines yesterday or the day before when the Pope made this statement. A lot of people interpreted that as a slap at the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, or a slap at the President of the United States. How should people interpret that? Again, my own take is that he's using language that I think is inartfully broad there, because I assume he's talking about unjust war. Otherwise, he'd be in conflict with, from my understanding and from my Catholic friends, Catholic doctrine itself.
No, I think that's the right distinction, the one that you made. And of course, you know, Pope Leo is an Augustinian. So he's shaped by the Augustinian intellectual and spiritual tradition. And it was Augustine, as you suggest, who was the first major figure in Christianity to give us a just war theory. Now, mind you, Augustine was very strong on peace and that the God revealed in Jesus Christ crucified is a God of peace and nonviolence. Augustine held to that. He held to a critique of Rome that was predicated upon the constant use of violence. So Augustine is no warmonger. But he also recognized in a finite, fallen, conflictual world, sometimes the only way to oppose deep injustice is through the violence of warfare. And then he gave us these criteria. Thomas Aquinas amplified them and so on. So I think that's the right distinction. The Pope is certainly critiquing an unjust war or someone who's invoking God to support an unjust war. And I furthermore agree with you that, you know, he's not referring specifically or precisely to the Iran war. And if you want to look at a situation, look at it in light of the seven criteria that determine whether war is just or unjust. And, you know, right, if you say simply God does not hear the prayers of warriors, well, then Abraham Lincoln and, you know, George Washington and Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. So I think what he meant, I think you're making the right distinction. It's the prayers of those who are seeking his sanction for an unjust war.
Yeah, Bishop Barron, yeah,
It's interesting there in that interview as well is in another clip you can find. I'm going to play it here. But I remember some years ago, Bishop Barron got critiqued heavily because he's on the Ben Shapiro show. And I think Shapiro asked him, you know, do I have to believe in Jesus to be saved or something like that? And Bishop Barron calls Jesus the privileged way or something like that. So it's interesting to see this interaction where it wasn't even a question. And Bishop Barron inserts into their conversation that Jesus is the fulfillment of Judaism. And he spends a lot of time just talking about Paul, how Paul's a Jew and how Paul's, you know, he speaks a lot about, he's writing a lot about. And so he's going on and on about how Catholicism is the fulfillment of Judaism. And so he does it unsolicited. And and I think maybe he does that because he knew the criticism is out there. And so I thought that was, I thought that was interesting. But so, yeah, again, the issue that all of Bishop Barron's haters right now have is when he says here, well, one group of his haters is that he seems to interpret the Pope to agree with him. And so a lot of people on the anti-war Catholics, Catholic polys, they would say that clearly that Pope Leo, it was speaking about the war in Iran, calling it unjust and all these things like this. And Barron is here to interpret the Pope and say, no, he was just speaking in general, not about. And so they're calling him soft here. They saying he cowered down to Shapiro, you know, who's a Jew, who's in favor of the Iran war, who wants to see it press further. And so just kind of it reminded me of when I think it was Gregory, the Pope that issued the most definitive statement about chattel slavery and calling it immoral. And this is like in 1800s. And then bishops here in the United States were saying, oh, the papal bull doesn't really mean that. We can still enslave people here in the United States. So you have bishops, even though they're supposed to be in union with the Pope, who's the source of the unity of the bishops, you still have bishops throughout history of the church always reinterpreting the Pope to agree with whatever agenda that they have. And then, so along with that, here comes Pope Leo the 14th speaking just I think this was Tuesday, so this was yesterday.
Come tutti sappiamo, c'è stato anche questa minaccia contro tutto il popolo di Iran. E questo veramente non è accettabile. Qui ci sono questioni certamente di diritto internazionale, ma molto di più una questione morale per il bene del popolo completo, intero. E vorrei invitare tutti a pensare nel cuore veramente di tanti innocenti, tanti bambini, tanti anziani, totalmente innocenti che sarebbero anche loro vittime di questa escalation di una guerra che ha cominciato già dai primi giorni. Dicevamo torniamo al dialogo, negotiations, cerchiamo come risolvere i problemi senza arrivare a questo punto. Invece siamo qui, bisogna pregare tanto, vorrei invitare tutti a pregare, ma anche a cercare come comunicare forse con i congressisti, con autorità, a dire che non vogliamo la guerra, vogliamo la pace. Siamo un popolo che ama la pace e c'è tanto bisogno di pace nel mondo.
Yeah, so there's the Pope once again stressing that the violence has to end. We have to return to dialogue. We have to talk about this. And just really calling for peace, really not leaving. And as I say, I would say it's the one thing I find refreshing so far with Pope Leo the 14th is that there's just no compromise with this guy. None whatsoever. He doesn't place any options in his very clear communication style any way to interpret him otherwise than what he's saying. So it's weird to hear that Barron would dare reinterpret him to agree with him. When Leo, you know, you can disagree with him, but it's interesting that he places he's 10 toes down on what he stands on. And there's no movement whatsoever. And he's not even negotiating with the world in this way. He isn't saying, well, I know the world wants this, but, you know, the church, we believe this. No, he doesn't even care. He's just standing 10 toes down on who Jesus is, the King of Peace. And that's all he has to say. And so it's refreshing that it's just a much higher standard that he's calling us to. The problem is that we live in a world that is not ready. Our hearts are just hard, right? And in a way, this is still the same world that killed God, right? The highest, and Benedict XVI says this, he talks about how the highest virtue in the world, like the best that the world can offer, the darkness in the world, the best that we can offer is death. That's our greatest good. Like, we really think killing people is a virtue, whether it's abortion, euthanasia, the death penalty, war. If we can kill somebody, we've fixed something. We fixed something. Whatever your problem was, if you could just kill a human being, you fixed it. Right? So death and murder are our virtues in the world. And so I don't think the world is ready to really hear that Jesus is the King of Peace. Right? The world is not ready to hear that every opportunity in the Gospels when Christ could have chose death, whether it's the woman caught in adultery, himself didn't have to come back from the dead, and so many other instances that he chose life. He could give us sacraments of death. But every sacrament he gave us was for life and life abundant. So in a world just isn't ready to hear that, because murder and death are still our virtues. And so I do like that about our current pontiff, that he's standing 10 toes down. You know, just something very basic that the world isn't ready to hear. And so what happens when this happens, you know, you've been probably been in situations like this where you're in a situation with somebody who's just uncompromising. It could be a relationship. It could be a supervisor. It could be, I don't know, you've been pulled over by a cop, right? So there's no negotiation. There's no opportunity for payola, any bribes or anything like that. So you have a choice. Either you're going to move towards that person or you're going to move away, right? Or you're going to just stay where you are because they're not coming to you. They're not bargaining. There's no negotiation. You're in a car dealership and the price is the price. You're at CarMax. They're not changing their price. It just is what it is. So you're going to buy the car or not. So that's good. You know, I was in Rome, and so this is what I want to talk about. I see a movement, a trajectory towards this this idea, right? That just war isn't applicable to most situations. That there is something called just war, but nowadays, It's hard to get there, and that's where the church is headed. And so, you know, I was in, like you guys know, I was in Rome, you know, on Palm Sunday when Pope Leo, when he dared to preach, I think words that like stunned people who want to square. I didn't go to the St. Peter's Square. I went to just an American mass for Palm Sunday. Wish I was at the square, but I wouldn't been able to understand it anyway. It wasn't in English, but But so Palm Sunday, he says, brothers and sisters, this is our Lord Jesus Christ, King of Peace, who rejects war, whom no one can use to justify war. He does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war, but he rejects them, saying, even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. And so I heard he said that not long after, in the afternoon. I said, I think I read it on my phone. I was like, oh, wow, that's something. I wish I was there for that. Because I knew this was the direction that Leo was headed. And I knew this is the direction that the church has been headed, just as I knew the church was headed towards saying that the death penalty was inadmissible. You can, if you pay attention to the details, the things that the church is writing, the counts, the conferences are writing, you see where the church is headed with some things. And we can call this development of doctrine, which is really just what we believe. The Holy Spirit is what Jesus said it was, that the Holy Spirit is guiding us towards all truth. Like, truth doesn't happen like a light switch, but the Holy Spirit guides us towards something. And some of the best examples, I would say, so people always ask me, like, okay, well, what other examples do you have besides the death penalty when a church believed something for hundreds of years, but then all of a sudden changed it? Well, there's a lot of things. I think the most obvious one that people point out is just slavery. And some of the clear documents that sanction slavery. And some people say, well, it didn't sanction chattel slavery. Well, that's not the point. The point is, like, human bondage. The church said was okay. And that was never dogmatically taught. You never had to believe that as a Catholic, but we cannot say that was a magisterial teaching, right? And so the church overturns that. Usury was another one. The money lending for interest. That's another clear one. There's a couple other ones I can't think on the top of my head, but those would be the most common ones where we see, like, a clear break. Oh, and then the other one is related to the death penalty. And so before you can, and so a lot of people don't know this. And so this is why when you get to the Second Vatican Council, and I think it had to be Gaudium et Spes. The church issued this document and this dogmatic constitution. And in there, the church had issued a statement about calling all torture inhumane. I said torture is inhumane. Okay. Which is very interesting if you understand church history, because ever since 1252, the church had magisterially taught that torture was licit, that it's okay to just torture people. And so the church had believed it long before that, but in 1252, in a document called Ad Exparanda, the church teaches that that all rulers of cities shall force heretics to confess their errors. And it says that they may use torture, but without danger to life or limb. So this was the teaching of the church, that you just torture people and force them to confess. And we all know that sometimes you torture someone, you don't know when death can happen. You don't know the limits. Have you been to torture museums? I've been to a lot of torture museums here in Europe. I'm fascinated by them. And so you, the devices are horrendous, well, many of them. So you don't know the limits of a human person. So torture oftentimes does lead to death. And so this is the teaching of the church. And so, so we get to Vatican II. Vatican II finally, in Gaudium et Spes, effectively rendered the logic of the previous teaching obsolete. And it condemned torture and said that torture is infamy. And so again, these are clear examples of, again, yeah, it does happen. The church will teach one thing and will completely annihilate it because the Holy Spirit guides us towards all truth. And we should be thankful for that. But the death penalty cannot be, we cannot get to the point of, you know, the church entering that phrase into the teaching of death penalty in 2017, calling a death penalty contrary to the gospel. And unless we get to veritatis splendor, under John Paul II, because in veritatis splendor, so up until now, so death penalty and torture are connected. Historically, if you wanted to kill someone, you tortured them first. You see with Jesus, you're tortured, and then you're given a death penalty. These two are always intimately linked. And oftentimes, the torture becomes the death penalty. So you're tortured to death, or you're tortured first. There are very few examples when those two don't go together. One would be Roman citizens would be just be given a sword, right? So when the Second Vatican Council was saying we can't torture people, that was a first strike against the death penalty because those two go together. So then that is why you see councils of bishops like in Indiana and the USCCB in 74, Indiana in 69, and throughout the world, and governments throughout the world, just moving away from the death penalty, right? There are very few countries in the world that still kill people, right, because of crimes. But something still has to happen. Veritatis splendor has to come along. And veritatis splendor is really the church reforming her moral doctrine, right? I would call it new. People would push back against me and say it's not new. They would say it's reform. They would say it's really grounding the scholastic moral theology. But I call it new because something completely new entered our moral theology. Jesus Christ entered it. So veritatis splendor is saying that the way that we have to look at moral theology is through Jesus Christ himself, who is the truest good. There's nothing good outside of God. So for us to know what is good, what is true, what is moral, we have to look at Christ. So the church decided to shape a moral theology that has Christ at the center. Christ at the center was a moral theology. And then, so this is why the church then reinforces this our belief that the ends does not justify the means. Now, with this in place, now this is what allows the church to finally get to the place it did in 2017, where it says that the death penalty is contrary to the gospel. She can't say that before veritatis splendor, that is contrary to the gospel, because the gospel is not the center of our moral theology. It's, you know, it's proportionalism and all these other things, you know. And so so that's what allowed that veritatis splendor allows us to get to this place. Now, let me return to Leo. So that's I bring that all up to show you how development works over time and through documents and paying attention to these little phrases in Gaudium et Spes. When it talks about torture, no one knew what that was really about, right? So you got to pay attention to these little things, these little nuggets over time that shows you where the church is headed. Now, can we do that with just war? Absolutely, we can. And that's what's amazing. Because there's been so many documents written that's anchored in the moral theology of veritatis splendor that suggests that the church is really looking at that and really thinking about whether, under what circumstances can war actually be just? And And what the church is, looks to be saying is that that is very, very limited. And Gaudium et Spes, we go back to Gaudium et Spes, which talks about torture, also talks about the horror and the perversity of war. And it's immensely magnified. John Paul is talking about it. Benedict the 16th, he's talking about it. There's something called a compendium of the social doctrine in 2004. All of these things, all these documents have one thing in common. They're saying that war is not good for humanity and that the just war criteria must be interpreted with this great strictness. It's like we're in a very narrow way to say what is truly self-defense. And what is truly self-defense? And so this is why you see a lot of bishops, a lot of conferences, and a lot of people now talking about how war is just really just, it's a war, the war industry complex. That term keeps coming up, that war now is just a boardroom decision, right? So the same people who sell the weapons are the same people who rebuild, or I would say the fund managers, you know, Blackstreet, Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock, all these fund managers and all these Boeing, all the people who make the things that destroy profit off of destruction, but they're also the same people who profit off of rebuilding those countries up. You look at all the countries, all the businesses ready to make money off of Ukraine, ready to sweep into Iran, make some money there, sell some steel, sell some mortar, sell some guns, sell some nails. It's all the same people who are profit off of destruction, also profit of rebuilding. The war industry complex profits off of human suffering. And so the church looks at that and saying that this isn't a time of the Mongols. This isn't a time of the Visigoths. It isn't a time of barbarians just sweeping across Europe that we have to put chastity belts on our women so they won't get raped. This isn't the world we live in. War is a boardroom decision and it causes human suffering. And so you see the church talking about that. So when Leo gets to the point saying that Christ is the King of Peace, that he rejects war, he does not hear the prayers of those who wage it. And people thought, oh, Pope Leo, he's crazy. He's a modernist. He's a Freemason. He's weird. No, so many other popes had interpreted Isaiah that same way. I have an article coming out over at the Catholic Stand where I review that if they publish it. I've been writing a lot of essays. I decided to write 12 essays about Pope Leo's homilies and, you know, whatever he's putting out. I told them I was going to do like a fellowship there and I'll do this for a year. So if they accept this one I just wrote, you know, if they don't, I just put it on my Substack. But I go through all the different fathers and saints who use that same verse to say the same thing Leo did. The only thing Leo does different in that verse than everyone else did, from Clement Alexandria to Origen to St. John Chrysostom to Aquinas to even Francis, is that he's using that verse also. So everybody said that that God doesn't hear the prayers of people who are warmongers. Everyone has said that. Only thing Leo added that was new was that he taught about the incompatibility of prayer with bloodshed and war when it's justified by religious rhetoric. That's what's new. The religious rhetoric piece is the only thing that's really new. But everybody, so many other people have used that verse, say, you know, God doesn't hear the prayers of warmongers. So, but I think that's where we're headed. I don't know if it's going to be this year or sometime before his pontificate ends, God knows when. But I think Leo is eventually going to get to the place, obviously, and this is where all the documents are leading us to believe. If you pay attention to some of the details and everything everyone is saying, the bishops and the conferences and so forth, War is going to, just war, the idea is going to have to be, it's going to be tweaked in a catechism in a way that you still see some continuity with Aquinas, but you also see that it's going to be like putting a pair of pliers onto some aluminum foil. It's just really going to be really tight, really, really narrow. And it's going to be almost impossible to thread a needle through there, right? You have to find a path, because the church is saying, you know, yeah, there's self-defense. But these modern day wars are just inadmissible to the idea of a just war, which is truly for self-defense. Why? Because it causes too much human suffering. People suffer from this, and it's a corporate venture. Right. And that's something we just have to recognize, right? We can listen to all the politicians and all the rhetoric and all this, but we know Nancy Pelosi, who's that warmonger guy? Lindsey Graham. These people have made millions of dollars off of war. It just is what it is, right? It's a billion-dollar industry. And what it does is it makes people suffer so that the 1% can get more wealthy. And nobody really cares. So that's going to be interesting. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. All right. This has been David L. Gray. I appreciate you guys. It looks like my video went away for a while. Yes, sir. Sorry about that, but you heard my wonderful voice, so that's cool. All right, let me get to some of your comments, and we'll get out of here. Yankee City girl has been known it today. Real talk, life. Lofton would sell his soul to get a photo op in the Oval Office. Anyone rebuke anybody? I mean, that's real talk. That is real talk. That's a lot of people, right? You can talk that game, but yeah, when push comes to shove, are you really really about that life? Whatever, man. Black Democrats who are Catholic fit the description of a religious leader. Being in the presence of Trump is a threat to democracy and black community. Right? Right? That's wild. And out of the billion Catholics, right? How many even know who Bishop Barron is? Catholic social media betrays his provincialism by being so U.S. censored. That's, again, more real talk. That's like a powerful point. I like to call it the word I use. I don't think it's arrogant supremacy. I think there is like a U.S. supremacy in a sense when it comes to just this worldview. And I use that oftentimes in sense like the traditional Latin mass. I thought, like, the rad trads have such an American supremacist idea of Catholicism that's really not compatible with the interests of Catholics anywhere else in the world. It just isn't. I've never heard anyone anywhere fuss about should you receive in a hand or on a tongue. That's not even a conversation. Maybe it should be. I don't know. I think there's a reverent way to receive communion, right? But just these issues that the American rad trad debates, no one else is talking about. So yeah, but I think that applies to politics too, with the Catholic polis. Caleb Buchanan, I appreciate you, man. I appreciate you. Thank you for noticing the catechesis comedy that I'm doing, man. Appreciate that. Check out my Father Hell Nah skits. Yeah, and Yankee City Girl makes a good point. Like, and this is my criticism of Pope Leo as well, that, you know, when I ran, you know, when they had the whole color revolution, remember E. Michael Jones was on talking about this as well when I had asked him about it. So they have this whole color revolution. It's probably funded by the CIA, but tens of thousands of people are jailed. Thousands of people are murdered on the streets. Pope Leo is silent about that whole thing. Yeah, that's fair. Jim say we're not supposed to pray with non-Catholics. I don't, you know, like, when I'm in the presence of, like, non-Catholics praying, I don't repeat what they're praying. I just say, okay, let's all pray. Everyone repeat after me. As Catholics, we don't do that. And Barron didn't do that. Not that I saw. And when Paula White is praying, all of that stuff she's praying, I don't see Barron, like, do the sign of the cross after she prays. Right. So if someone is praying and you as a Catholic is just there, you could be there. This may happen. But do you participate? Right. I think that's the distinction. And I think that's what you're saying, pray with non-Catholics. I wouldn't say he was present, but I won't say Barron was praying with. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't see him doing anything that would suggest that he's more than just a fly in the room. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't see him nodding. I don't see him doing a sign of the cross. So he's just present. That's a fair question. That's a fair question. I hear people respond to me when I bring up these points, and they bring up the Battle of Lepanto and Our Lady of the Rosary and these things. You know, so, I mean, what do you do with that? Well, maybe you do the same thing with it that you do with the papal executioner. Forget his name, but he murdered hundreds of people. When a church was teaching that priests were not allowed to participate in the death penalty whatsoever. But if you're a lay person, like, you're the papal executioner, you just murder as many people as you want to. There was, like, this, if this is true, then why isn't it good for everyone? Why is it bad for priests to participate in the death penalty, right? So what's somebody like? What do you do with that? Right. You know, you just recognize things in their time, kind of like how Jesus recognized things in his time. Like, yeah, like, you heard it said, like, yeah, Moses allowed you to divorce your spouse, but that's because your hearts were hard. Maybe that's what you do with it. Just recognize that things are where they are. Thanks, sis. I appreciate you. I wonder where you're at. I said, where's Brianna at? Where's she at? Is she playing golf? What's really good? Well, thanks for coming in. Marmar saying, I was asked a few years ago to join a prayer warrior group. It sounded prosit to me. I didn't show. That does sound like 100% prosit, does it? I'll do the same thing, like a prayer warrior group. Like, what's this? Yeah, but they had a. I've seen Catholics do that, and it's just I don't know. It just feels Protestant to me. All right. Yeah, Lori, I'm about that life. I'm about that 360 surveillance. All about that. I don't have it here in Germany though. I don't know why. I don't know, because I think the cameras I brought with me, of course, they don't work in the plugs. I can't plug them in here. And I think that I just never, I've been too lazy to, you know, get a new system. But I'll tell you what, you know what I mean? Nights that we accidentally leave the front door open. I mean, like, swung open. I don't know. The neighborhood I live in, I mean, maybe I'm just blessed. And I probably take that for granted. One day, we're going to leave our front door open. And you're going to see me on the news for taking somebody out. Let me see. It's the prayer word type theology that rubs my Catholic self the wrong way. Yeah, yeah, that's true. All right, my friends. Let me get out of here. I appreciate you guys hanging in there for the 140. I'll make sure I drop the timestamps in, and I will catch you on the Friday. But until then, until next time, blessings and peace to you and to yours. This has been David O'Gray in the morning. Peace.
Hey, yo, wake up. New mercy, fresh light on the way. Coffee in the cup, let the silence pray. Word for your walk, truth for your mind. We read the signs, but we don't lose time. Culture talk, scripture sharp. Faith with rhythm, intellect with heart. No panic, no noise, just wisdom and grace. Morning hits different when you start in this place. Wake up, yeah. Tap in right now, let the truth hit soft, let it hit profound. Wake up, don't scroll past prayer. It's David L. Gray in the morning, meet me there. Yeah, yeah. Think clear, breathe deep, set your pace. Faith ain't heavy when it's put in place. Start with God, then face the day. That's the kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah, let it play. Share it, yeah, pass it on your way. Sub up, don't hesitate. David L. Gray in the morning, don't be late. Wake up.